Welcome all to Q&A, and welcome to any new people we might have with us here tonight. We welcome guests at any time at the AutoPiece User Group. If you want to join, we'd love to have you join the group, but you don't feel obliged to do so. I am now going to mute all, and you will have the ability to unmute yourself if you want to. Feel free to do so for comments or questions. Please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, contents of the deck in PDF format, the audio track, and the contents of the chat window will be going up on our website. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chris. And we have a potpourri of information tonight, a whole bunch of different things. And I'm going to start off with something I've been working on personally. I've been doing some more programming. In particular, I'm trying to automate some tasks which I normally do manually. And some of these things I really like to run on both Windows and Linux. And the other possibility is that I may even develop an application that might be useful to somebody else, in which case I would release it as a working package and probably open source. And
Alan, if I can interrupt for a second, I thought maybe it was just me, but Carol says that she's seeing it too. It's a black square in the center of the screen.
Yeah, I'm seeing it too.
There we go. We're good now.
Oh.
There we go.
You want to hear a programmer?
Yep. Yep. Everything is fine now. Timothy's saying he's getting the gray square.
I don't understand that. I'll stop sharing my screen and try again.
Okay.
I had it off, so I was going to reboot, but I'm back on it.
I've lost my Zoom controls. So that one, and so now we've got the title slide.
Okay, and I have no square in the middle. Oh, I have a bit of a square up near the top. Really weird. A long rectangle. There it's gone.
The rectangle's gone now.
Oh, yeah. I think that's the Zoom controls. For some reason, they show up on the second monitor. Across the top of my second screen, but of course you don't see that, I think. Not supposed to, anyway.
Let's try again. Yeah, okay, go.
We'll try again here. All right, so I've been looking at different programming languages, and I've been looking at Python. I've used that quite a bit. But one of the problems with Python, it's an interpreter, so you don't generate an executable file. So it means that people have to install Python. And the problem with Python is it's kind of modular. So there's a whole raft of different modules that the user has to install. So for other people, I mean, that's no problem for me. I can do that. But for other people, I think that's way too much of good news. So then I looked at C, and because I've never used C previously, but I've heard a lot about C, and everybody uses C for everything. And it does have a compiler, a free compiler, GNU compiler, and there's a linker, so you get an executable file out of it. But they say there's a steeper learning curve, which I have found to be true in the last few days. And one of the problems is it's a really weird language in that it doesn't have things like string functions. So you have to develop a string using a bunch of characters, essentially. And that seems like a lot of work for things that you're dealing with when you're dealing with text files. Both of these languages have been around for a long time, and there's lots of on-screen help and tutorials and things. And actually, that's what I really want to talk about is I actually started looking for tutorials, and I came across this website called Tutorials for Beginners, Beginner's Book. And as you can see here, he has a whole raft of tutorials on all kinds of different languages. So if you're interested in Java programming, or here's the C one, for example. And then down here, if you're interested in WordPress, then there's a module for that too. So it's all kinds of different things. And if you click on one of these things, then you'll find that there's a whole bunch of text. And it's really well organized, done by various sections. And when you go to a section, you get things like a demonstration program, how to actually program. And then he starts talking about how, let's understand that. What do all these bits and pieces mean? So it truly is a pretty good tutorial from kind of beginner type level. And the guy that seems to be responsible for all of these things on his website, he doesn't really take credit for anything. But when you look at his tutorials, it does say it's by Chaitanya Singh. So it sounds like a Indian or Indonesian or something. So he's actually developed all of these tutorials. And then he also has navigation built in. So once you started reading down the tutorial, you get to the bottom and you have like forward and backward type functions. So you can scroll through the presentation very easily. So if you have any interest in any of those kind of programming languages, these on-screen tutorials are actually pretty good. I quite recommend them. So that's it for me and programming. And I'm hoping everybody's seeing the slides really now. I'm not seeing any bad news in the chat window.
Yeah, I think
so. Let's move along. And Chris has got one of his famous rants.
Yeah, I can't believe that companies pull off stunts like this. I don't know what's going through their minds and so forth. But anyway, I happen to use a program called Snagit from TechSmith for screen capture, and really, really nice program, very capable and so forth. It's a lot more functions that is built into Windows, typically in the snipping tool. Next. And I found that just after installing July's Windows updates on Patch Tuesday, pressing the print screen key, which used to open Snagit and allow me to do a capture of a region, instead started opening up Windows Snipping Tool. So I went through and I was looking at all kinds of things within Snagit, had it lost the hotkey setting for it, various things like that. And next, I finally had to go to Google University, as Alan is wont to term it, to find a solution. And sure enough, I did find a solution. You have to go into Settings, Accessibility, Keyboard. And then there was, I presume, a brand new option or newly turned on option saying use the print screen key to open Snipping Tool. And sure enough, when I went there, it was checked. And so if I toggle that off, and I actually had to do a reboot even, and I had to stop swearing at Microsoft for wasting half an hour of my time trying to solve this problem. So. Next. So I went to the feedback hub. Everybody knows that I am a fan of sending feedback to Microsoft. Whether I'm yelling into the void or not, I don't know. But I went to the feedback hub and I did a bunch of searching. And I searched on a phrase, stop taking over control of print screen button. And sure enough, I had a hit here of somebody who had exactly the same problem that I had, because he said, don't take over the print screen key without asking me. And he uses Snagit, just like I did, and he uses the print screen key to initiate a screen capture. And he said, I don't appreciate you reassigning the key to take it over with the Snagit tool. So I went next and put in a reply to that. I upvoted it. That's one hint too. If you're in the feedback hub, upvotes count for more than new feedback. So it is always worthwhile to check in the feedback hub to see if somebody has already raise the issue that you're raising and upvote it rather than putting in a new feedback. And so I upvoted it and I did a reply to it. And I said, I ran into this today after installing the Windows updates. And I said, Microsoft, stop taking over keystrokes that are in use by other programs. That is bully behavior, shows no respect for your users or the rich third-party ecosystem that helped make Windows a success. So, again, I don't know if I'm yelling into the void on this, but hopefully somebody at Microsoft will take it to heart to say that, well, yeah, maybe that's not a polite thing for us to do and stop doing things like that. Do I believe that that's really going to happen? No. Did it make me feel a little bit better going in and ranting at Microsoft? A little. And that's it for tonight's rant.
So Tim has put a comment. He says, we're never going to stop swearing at Microsoft. So I have a question for you. I tried to use Windows Hub, is it called? Feedback Hub.
Feedback Hub, yep.
And I tried to search for my problem, and I've never been successful in finding my problem, which I find amazing. It can't be just me. So what's the secret to searching Feedback Hub?
I don't know. It is a word for word match is best. It will find things that seem to be related. But other than that, I don't know. But I've never been good at searching. I've never been good at searching at Google or Bing or any of the search engines. I usually find some stuff, but it's not really, I don't ever get the feeling that I've gotten a targeted response in my searches. So I don't know. Just try different terms, synonyms for things that you're looking for. But outside of that, I really don't know.
Okay. Sounds like you and me both were candidates for Bob Harris's favorite ChatGPT.
It could be,
give it lots of search terms and let it rip.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Chris. Good luck on that one.
Yeah.
Okay, moving along, we've got a question from a member a long time ago. What YouTube videos or channels do you recommend? And Stuart has one, which is 9 to 5, I'm told.
Yes, work hours only. No. 9 to 5 Google. You can learn a lot about Google and people that like Google on this YouTube channel. It's actually a media group. And Linus doesn't have his hand in it. It may even predate Linus. We're not sure. But if I could have the next slide. Yes, since 2014. So I think Linus was born then anyway. It focuses on Google stuff, Android software, the phones, the Google Pixel and Chromebooks, Chrome OS, pretty much anything to do with Google and its vast ecosystem. And to be in full disclosure, I haven't watched one of the YouTube reviews for quite a while now. I've been kind of cutting down on them because I mean, there's only so many YouTube tech reviews you can watch before you go crazy. But they were good when I watched them. However, the website is excellent. If I could have the next slide. Because they also have an Apple channel. And this is not a plug for Apple. But it shows that the media group doesn't just focus on Google. The slide's wrong. The home website, the Apple channel is 9to5mac.com. But anyway, oops. Well.
My fault.
And they do the exact same with Apple stuff. And as you can see here, if you go up to the top of the screen on the website and beside the header that is the title for that particular page, the little down arrow will show you all the other websites that are part of the media group, which is 9to5Mac, 9to5Google, 9to5Toys. I'll let your imagination run wild with that. Electric, that's sort of focused on electric autos and mobility of various things. Another one's on drones. Bob, are you paying attention? Okay. And space. A lot of focus here on SpaceX, but, you know, other companies too. So you can pick your poison for the day and go and read that before you read any of the other ones. And if you'd rather get it in a different format than a web page, well, the little plus symbol on the top right of the screen on any of these pages will show you all the, what do you call those things? platforms, social channels that the media group uses. There's Twitter channels, there's YouTube, of course, probably a Discord. All the places the kids go. Facebook. I'm sure they're there too. There's a whole bunch of them. And you have really thoughtful, well done reviews in a professional manner for each of these topics that I mentioned. Google, Mac, toys, electric cars, drones, and space. So, 9 to 5. Not just for Dolly Parton anymore.
Okay, thanks very much, Stuart. Okay, we're going to move along, and we're going to stick with Stuart, although he actually doesn't know it, and we'll hear from him a little later, but it'll be hearing from him in a different sort of way. Stuart actually sent this suggestion into Suggestion Box a number of months ago, almost a year ago, actually. And it kind of got left at the top of the list of messages and didn't really get acted on until I found it just recently. And basically it's a teleprompter for your smartphone, for your mobile device, as they say. It's a free version, or there is a free version, which has limited capabilities. And if you pay for it, then obviously you get more features. Now, by a teleprompter, I guess if you look at the picture, this is essentially your phone, you're taking a selfie sort of thing, and you can read the words that you want to tell people on your self-produced video using this kind of scrolling script that's at the top of the screen. And when you're looking, and when you're reading that script, you're almost looking straight at the camera. So people are listening to your talk and thinking that you're looking right at the camera and making this stuff up as you go along. But of course, you're actually reading a script, a teleprompter. So as it says in the features here, you can create word perfect videos if you have any interest in doing this kind of stuff. You can record videos in a single take because you just read the script and make it go as it goes along. And because you can read the words, you don't have to do what I'm doing and say, maybe you have to think about what you're going to say next. And as it says, you can maintain eye contact with your audience. And so Stuart actually gave us a demonstration of this thing. And hopefully, I was having some technical issues with the sound here, but I'm hoping that by playing this, you get the general idea. So this is Stuart's demo of a teleprompter video.
Hello. I have been racking my mind to figure out what I could say in this demonstration that might inspire you to try out this application. As I read the prompts and deal with the multitasking I'm unaccustomed to, it becomes clear that I need this app. Without it, this will be a demonstration of how an average person will be overwhelmed by a relatively simple task.
Yay! Good on, Stuart. So that was a demo of the video prompt app. It was actually more text and more information than that longer video, but I cut it down just for the sake of time. Anyway, I hope Stuart's going to do more of these things, and he'll do the technical reviews using his teleprompter video in future. So thanks very much, Stuart, for the suggestion, and hopefully people will take that up and try it out, and we'll see the fruits of their labors.
I have to apologize along with Alan on the delay of this item, and Alan sent it to me the other day and said, do you remember this? And I said, well, I don't know. I thought we'd taken it up at Q&A, and then just today I actually found it in my Q&A folder way, way down there. And so I apologize that we missed that, but we did eventually get around to it.
Yeah, it's a kind of neat app too, actually.
Yeah, very cool.
Okay,
thank you. Before you go on, I have to thank you. I thought I thought it had been gone, forgotten completely. My all that work was for nothing.
The crowd loved it, Stuart. It took about three takes,
and I had to actually use another program to shrink the video down to a manageable size because the finished product, well, I don't know, it's on a tablet somewhere. I can't remember how big it was, but it wasn't very practical for trying to upload. Mm-hmm. So I used VSDC file converter and shrank it down to whatever size it is you have now and sent it off to you guys as a demonstration. But that's a review for another day.
Yeah, that's the problem with videos. The files are generally so huge and they're just unmanageable. No, I think whatever you do, I think they're huge. Anyway, let's move along. And Chris has got part three of his free file sync file history session.
Yeah. So next slide. So we started this journey off with the idea that we wanted to replace file history, which is built into Windows since Windows 8, I believe, and continues on into Windows 11, but they've done a lot of damage to it. And so I wanted to replace it with Free File Sync, which is a free and open source program that I was hoping would accomplish everything that file history was for me. And if you're interested in the background on that, the Q&A going back to June 28th actually has that topic. Next. The following week, on July 5th, I actually used Free File Sync to mirror my documents directory on drive C to an external hard drive plugged in, and it's on drive E, into a folder called Backup Documents. And the URL is there, if you want to review that. Next. And then the following week, on July 12th, what I did was I used Task Scheduler to automate that process. And that's an important part of what file history can do for us. It not only can duplicate some files off onto another drive, it can also automatically run in the background, or not can, it does run automatically in the background, so you just sort of set it and forget it. Next. And then what we're going to do this week is we're actually going to preserve old versions of files, so we have the file versioning aspect of what file history can actually do for us. Next. So when you have files that are modified, in my case, I'm replicating my documents folder on drive C, which is C users, C tailor documents, and I'm duplicating those files or mirroring them off to /documents. And it will overwrite or delete any copy that is in that if I modify or delete a file in my original documents folder. So if I create a new document, it will make a copy of that over there. If I edit an existing document in my documents folder, it will overwrite the copy that is in the backup directory. If I delete a file in my documents directory, Free File Sync will happily go ahead and delete the copy that is in the backup folder, backup documents on drive E. Next. So the reason is it is doing a mirror sync. So those files that are on drive E are always going to be exactly the same set of files that are found in the documents directory on drive C. So we're doing a mirror sync, and that's expected behavior for Free File Sync. Next. We don't really want that. So what we want to do is we want Free File Sync to do its thing, but before it overwrites a file or deletes a file, what we want to do is preserve the version of the file that is in /backup/documents somewhere else, and then do a normal operation, either overwriting or deleting the file that is in /backup/documents. Next. And Free File Sync can do this for us. So We go back to our job. So here we are in Free File Sync, and we have the job that we created before that is the mirror synchronization in the left-hand panel, and you click on it to select the sync job. You could have multiple jobs, so you just have to make sure you select the right job. Then you click the gear icon that is over by the synchronization tab near the top, and it's the tooltip for it is synchronization settings if you hover the mouse over top of it. Next. And then the default is, as you see on the screen, okay, if the default is that it any synchronization of the files on the destination, it's going to delete and overwrite the files, and it is going to send them to the recycle bin. So you can recover files without doing anything further by going to the recycle bin, but I want a little bit cleaner and more control over it than doing that. Next. So what we're going to do is click on versioning rather than recycle bin. Next. And then in the dialog box to, or the edit box to the right of that, it says move files to a user-defined folder. And in that, you put in where you want the versions of your files to actually go to. So I decided to \\versions\documents. Next. Then you have a naming convention. So when it moves that or copies that file before it overwrites it, what is it going to do? There are three options that you can actually have. Next. So there's a naming convention that could be either replace, and that'll only keep one version of the file, because what it'll do is it'll take, say it's going to edit or replace or update a file that is called, you know, mytaxes.docx or something like that. And I make a change to it before it overwrites that file in the backup document folder. It'll actually copy that file that is there then to this \\versions\documents folder. And if there is a copy there, like I edit that file twice, it'll just overwrite it. So it'll only keep one version of a document safe and sound if you use the replace option. That doesn't sound too great. Next. The next one is timestamp folder. And what that'll do is it underneath the \\versions\documents, it'll actually create a folder with the date and timestamp as part of the folder name, and it'll put the file in there. So the next time you edit that file, it'll say, okay, well, I have to preserve it, so I'm going to put it in a new timestamp folder because the time and date is different. So I'll create a new folder with the date and time and then put the version of the file in there. The problem with that is that you can end up with a huge number of folders, each with just a single file in it. The charm of that, I guess, is that it leaves the name the same. So it makes it simple to just go find the folder with the timestamp of the version of the file you want, and then go and copy the file back to its original location. Next. The last option that we have is timestamp file. And what that does is when it preserves a copy of the file, it actually names the file the original file name and then gives it the date stamp and the timestamp as part of the name. Next. And that funny looking number on there, 101552, that's actually just the timestamp on it. So this file was actually created at 10:15:52 on that particular date. So you can see that in this case, I can have multiple files that will all be stored in the same folder, \\versions\documents, and it just has that timestamp as part of the name. So I would have to go in and find the file that I want, copy it back out, and rename it back to the original or whatever else I want to do with it. Next. And as you can imagine from the way I've been talking, my preference is that third option, timestamp of file. So that's what I chose. Next. The next thing we have is limiting file versions. Okay, so next, if you click on any one of those checkboxes, it'll open up a dialog box below it. Next. So you have last X number of days, and then you have a minimum or maximum number of versions that you want to keep. So by default, it says you want to keep the last 30 days. So no matter how many times you actually change a particular file, it can actually keep the last 30 days worth of those files, whether it's zero because you didn't modify the file, up to thousands if you're modifying that file on an ongoing basis. Next. And then there are lots of combinations that are possible. So the first one is, like I said, just last X days, and it'll keep every version of the file that is less than a certain number of days old. You could have just maximum if you wanted, and then it'll keep a specified number of versions regardless of how old it is. So if you set a maximum of 5 and no last X days, it'll keep, you know, 5 versions, whether that's 1 day or 1 hour or whether it's 5 years. Or you can do combinations of it. So you could do last 30 days and a maximum. So you can say, only keep them for the last 30 days, but I also only want to keep the last 5 versions. So I'm changing this file maybe a lot of times, but I don't really care if it's 29 days ago or whether it was this morning that I did 5 versions. I just want to keep 5 versions, period, and I don't want it to go beyond X number of days. Or you can have last X days and a minimum. So you could have a minimum number regardless of the age of the file, et cetera. So you can mix and match those to whatever sort of thing that you want in terms of flexibility on the versions that you actually keep of files. This is one place where FreeSync is going way beyond the capability of file history, in that file history doesn't allow you to have that flexibility of, you know, just going by the number of days or number of versions of files that you keep and things like that. So kind of neat that you have that capability. Next. Okay, then what you do is you save the sync job. So you change the settings for the synchronization job itself. So you save the sync job. Next.
Tom has a question, I think.
I don't see it, so he must have sent it just to you.
I see something that says Tom's iPad raised hand.
Oh, I see. Okay, Tom?
Yes, one question. It might be useful to have a version that is like every 7 days or every week. I gather there's nothing to handle that. For example, just to save the versions, unless you go in manually and delete the ones you don't want.
Yeah, you would have to do it manually, because the way this is it's just triggered by the fact that there was a change in the file, and so therefore, what do you do about the version? And so there's nothing that says, oh, okay, I saved one yesterday, so don't save one now. There's nothing like that. So you'd have to manually go in and play around with those. Now, quite frankly, when I come to, and this works with file history as well, I find that typically the number of changes I'm making to files, they aren't really that many. And so, you know, typically I'll just let it do like 30 days worth or something like that. And most files, you know, they might get changed a couple of times. There are a few files that I'll work on, you know, maybe a half a dozen times. I'll be saving it a day, even working on, say, stuff for Q&A. You know, I might be working on a PowerPoint presentation and I'm saving it every 5 minutes. Well, it is making all of those copies of that file. So, yeah, I would have to go in, and if I didn't want to be chewing up to disk space, clean up those. But I find that overall, for an external hard drive, you know, it doesn't really use up that much space. And so I just let it run wild. So, we save our sync job, and next. So then you also have to save as a batch job. So we did this before, where we saved as a batch job. We have to save again as a batch job, because the batch job contains all of the parameters of the sync job within the batch job itself. So we save as batch job, next. And then it'll come up with the settings. Keep the same settings you had before. Next. And then keep the file, click on the save as, and then keep the same file name. And the reason why you want to keep the same file name is that we already set up last week for Windows Task Scheduler to run a specific batch job. And so we just want to overwrite that batch job so that when Task Scheduler runs it, it'll run the updated batch job. Next. So then we get into recovering old versions of files once you set this up and you let it run for a while. So here we have a case in point of I have freefilesync.pptx. So it's a PowerPoint file on this particular part of tonight's presentation. So I look at it and I go, oh, this used to be a multi-megabyte file. Okay, it's now down to 363 kilobytes, which is suspiciously sounds like an empty PowerPoint file. Most empty PowerPoint files are about that sort of size. So what happened was I accidentally deleted slides and then I saved the file. And you can see it's in my documents directory. So that's my working file that I'm developing for this particular presentation. And I deleted all the slides and I saved it. So then what happens? Next. So the first thing I might do is go and look at /backup/documents. And I can see that it's exactly the same size. So the reason is that the automatic synchronization already ran. So I have it set to run every 5 minutes. And so by the time I noticed that I had overwritten this file, synchronization had run and it is a mirror synchronization. So it is making sure that /backup/documents is always exactly the same contents as in my documents folder on my C drive. Next. So that's when I can go to /versions/documents. And I can see there I have freefilesync.pptx and I have three files. So the first one was saved on the 6th of July at 14:25:51. And it's exactly the same size. So versioning ran on it, and it saved that. So the next one down was saved the same day at 13:55:39, and it is 4 megabytes. And the oldest file that I have in that particular folder, so the oldest version I have, was actually saved at, or actually I guess it's the newest one, 14:09:46. So that is actually the most recent file that I have of that particular one, and it is the 4 megabyte file. So what I would do at that point is I would just make a copy of that file back to my original location. Next. Now, an interesting thing to note is that if I had not been using FreeFileSync in this particular scenario, all versions of the file were created and modified on the same day. So I run nightly backups on my computer. But the nightly backup would have nothing because it ran, 2 o'clock in the morning on July 6th. And so I would have nothing in my backups. And the only thing that would save me is the fact that FreeFileSync was running and making sure that every 5 minutes it captured any modifications to the files I was working on. And in this case, it would really save my bacon. I'd be able to get that file back. No problem at all. At most, I would lose 5 minutes worth of work. And I think, next slide. So the results that we've got so far. So in the first 2 weeks, the first one, first bullet point, we actually modified, we set up FreeFileSync so that e-backup documents will always have exactly the same files as the documents folder on my C drive. And last week's was checking for it was automatically running every 5 minutes, looking for those changes and doing that synchronization. Next. So new this week, we added /versions/documents, where all the old versions of files will be saved according to the scenario, the settings that I decided on how many versions I wanted to save and how old the versions could be and so forth. Next. So are we done? Not quite. So right now we're only backing up the documents folder on drive C to drive E. And in most cases, people want to do more than a single folder. So what we're going to do is add additional folders to be backed up as part of this whole scenario. And next, that will be covered next week. And that's it for me for today.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. There's nothing came of that in the chat, so everybody's made notes and are going to be working on it over the next week, I guess. Okay, moving along then, we're going to hear all about a mouse or two from Bob Harris. Bob's going to share his screen and make the presentation that way. Aren't you, Bob?
I'm muted now, too, and here we're going to share, and here we go. It should be...
Yep.
Here. Looks good.
Very good. Okay. So this is Mouse Tales tonight, folks, and I'll tell you about my experiences with mice. So my old mouse was about 2 years old when it died. It was a real hero. It came from a very good family. I didn't work it too hard, and I always had a bowl of water nearby. But it didn't last, I'm sorry. So in all seriousness, my old mouse was okay until I spilled coffee on it. Well, it was liquid anyway. It was a hero mouse, Logitech G502, cost about $60. And since it wasn't working, it was time to get a new mouse. So my shopping adventure began, mouse shopping. Here we go. This is the mouse that I found. I didn't want to spend a whole lot of money. This was a very cheap mouse. Here's the, you see it on here too. I got it in my hand. And so I didn't expect too much. I was very surprised. It starts off, it says customizable on here, and the next slide will show you. Out of the box, I get the instructions. There weren't many words in here. I have a choice of a black cover or a white cover in the lower half. The cable was really, I call it upper end quality. It's a braided anti-interference cable with a soft cloth covering on it. Looks very durable, and it's meant for anti-interference. And once again, there's the two color schemes you want to have here. I went for plain white. You can go for a black one too. This is a large mouse. I have other mouses or mice around here, and this is a large mouse by any standard. I really like it. Here. And lo and behold, amazing, it's got a tunable weight system. With the cover removed, it snaps on. There's three magnets on here, snap the cover on. It holds very securely. When you want it off, it comes off quite easily. This little weight drawer, you'll see in a minute here, this little weight drawer slides out. I was amazed. And there we go. A tunable weight system. Now, I like the heavier mouse, so I left all the weights in. And I think it's wonderful with the white cover on. And here's two little weights here. You pop those in little covers here and put it back in the drawer, and away you go. Now, the buttons are all pretty standard. You know, we have left and right, of course. But additional on here, I have the forward button and backward button. On your browser, the forward button and backward button work very good. I might mention on my Hero mouse, which was probably more of a real gaming mouse, I kept hitting those things all the time by accident. It drove me kind of crazy, so I wasn't that sad to see it go. And the roller wheel on this mouse is much better than the Hero mouse also. It's got a very grippy scroll wheel here. You can press down and then it'll scroll the whole screen slowly. It's top end quality. Oh, by the way, the lights are on here now. It's plugged in on the side here. The lights are on the side here. So going further here. Now, this mouse has a 12,000 DPI optical sensor with six adjustable settings from 1,000 to 12,000. Oh, I see questions here from Bill and Wayne, I guess, here. Sorry. They're asking, what is DPI? Well, glad you asked, guys. DPI is dots per inch. This refers to how quickly the mouse cursor moves across the screen. Now, a higher DPI rate means the mouse cursor moves faster. So this one has adjustable DPI settings. It's pretty cool. I didn't plan for all this for like $16, $19, $17. Anyway, it's all powered up now. And there's two more buttons on top we haven't discussed, but there's my left and right button. We have the roller and all that stuff. It's a nice mouse. Now, the cursor speed. We had your 1,000, 2,000, 3,200, 4,800, and on. You change these by hitting the forward button to increase it and the backward button to decrease it. Now, this part's unbelievable. You can change the DPI rate, or how fast the cursor moves, while you're using the mouse. Now, you all need to see this all at once. You're going to say, wow. I know you're all thrilled.
Wow.
Don't wait. There's more. Here we go once again with the pressing the DPI setter setting on top here. As you press this button while using the mouse, it turns red here momentarily. Otherwise, going to flowing colors on the mouse here. And we hit it again. And this is actually slower. It goes to the, I know it's ambiguous here, but this is actually the green. So it just dropped from 48 to 60, from 64 to 4800 by going backwards. You'd be surprised how often this is handy. I'm not a real gamer, but you're on a website. You're not going to go open up Windows and change the mouse speed and all that stuff. You do this on the fly with your finger, and you don't even need to look at the colors. A little faster, a little slower. It's quite cool. On the fly. Anyway, this is a great mouse. It did all I wanted right out of the box. Now, I didn't want to get the software, but I did look at it. It really wasn't good. I found this. You need this software if you want to change the mouse from left and right-handed. You would need the software. I put the software on. I really didn't use it. I haven't taken it off yet. But I didn't like the Logitech software either. I want a simple mouse. I'm not a real gamer. I want a nice mouse. And this met all those that criteria. So the software is there. And anyway, in summary, we have the Eska 200 mouse, customizable, black or white, your 12,000 DPI optical sensor, which changes the mouse speed, your red, green, blue backlighting, a tunable weight system, a great design for comfort, left or right-handed. I did shop the local stores before I bought this mouse, but I didn't want to spend a whole lot of money. The value, I think, exceeded the price. I bought this on Amazon for $16.99. You can get that now. And Chris mentioned, too, on the website, I saw this also, that this mouse isn't on the website. I don't know if it's a bit of a clearance thing, whatever. It is not a real, it isn't a real gaming mouse, but it's a lot better than the average mouse. It's great value. So in summary, this is it right here. I'm Bob Harris, and I approve this message.
Very good, Bob.
Thank you, everybody.
That was wonderful.
And there's the mouse right here.
And where's Bob. Your teleprompter?
Pardon me?
Where's your teleprompter?
Anyway, thank you, everybody. Any comments at all or complaints?
Bill's asking if they make it in a wireless version.
I didn't look for that. I passed that a couple of years ago. The wireless ones get definitely flaky at times. And I didn't always realize this, but I'm fed up with that stuff. I want the mouse to work when I want to do something. I'd like the mouse to work. When the batteries get a little weak too, I don't have the frustration. That's frustrating. So a wired mouse, I don't take it too far away. But I want it to work all the time, every time. And the wired mouse does that. So I'm a wired guy now. Anyway, thank you all. It's a great deal. And
that's a really neat piece of kit, Bob.
Yeah, great price.
I really scored on that. I didn't think I was going to get much for $17, but I didn't want to spend $60 or $120, and I was really shocked. So I wanted to share it with you folks. Now, if it's a clearance deal, it won't be available too long, but for me, it's a better mouse than I ever had before. It beats the Hero one, the real Logitech Hero, and by many factors. So,
okay, good mouse. Good. Anybody who's looking for a mouse, there's Bob's approved piece of kit. Thanks very much. Thanks
Thank
very
you,
much,
everybody. Bob. Thank you.
That was good.
Okay.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay, so we've got time, I think, for just one more short item, which comes to us from Stefan Vichar, but he can't be with us tonight, so Chris is going to... Chris has actually extended Stefan's original thought. So go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, Stefan came up with this solution for problems of printing on web pages. And in particular, he was creating PDFs of websites and having very poor results, shall we say. And I think everybody's run into this, printing or creating PDFs of files of web pages. Now, his solution was an edge-only solution, and I discovered that it was actually possible to do it in different browsers, so I extended it a whole bunch. So if we have a web page that looks something like this, and this was a sample page that he had done in his deck, and then next, if you actually create a PDF of it, you can end up with weird things like additional stuff that clutters up parts of the page, typically at the top or the bottom or something like that. Or worse, you can have it where there's stuff that is overwriting parts of the text of the page. And so you don't get, you know, a nice clean PDF showing you the contents of the web page. Next. So if you go to printerfriendly.com, and I'll paste it into the chat. Just do that right now. It is available for Firefox, Safari, and all Chromium-based browsers, which includes things like Google Chrome, Edge, Brave, Vivaldi, other browsers that are based on Chromium. And the trick is that you should go to the site using the browser that you want to add the extension into is the easiest way to make sure that you get it installed correctly. Now today I was doing a little bit, later today I was doing a little bit more, testing on this, and I found that in actual fact, Edge and Firefox, if you install into either of those two, you'll get the best feature set. Other Chromium-based browsers like Google Chrome, Brave, Vivaldi, and so forth, it works, but you have fewer options that are available currently in the extension. So you will get a more full-featured result in either Edge or Firefox. Next. So you click on the Install Browser extension, just follow the prompts through to install it into the browser that you're using. And if you are adding it to a non-Google Chrome or Edge, Chromium-based browser, you will get taken to a thing that says add Chrome extension. So even if you're using Brave or Vivaldi or whatever, just click on the Add to Chrome extension. Next. And then you will, once you get through all of the prompts and so forth, you'll have a pop-up that comes up on your toolbar that says, print friendly and PDF has been added to Microsoft Edge. If you don't see it on the toolbar, if you go to your extensions list, which is in the menus, you can actually tell it to pin it to the toolbar. So the extension gets added as an icon to the toolbar by default. Next. And then if you go to that web page, so here's that original web page that we were looking at. Next. And then you'll see on the toolbar there's a green printer icon, and you click on that. Next. And then you end up with a clutter-free page displayed. And so much cleaner. And it's gotten rid of ads and weird extra space and things like that, and you end up with all of the content of your page being displayed correctly. Next. Now, over on the left-hand side, you'll have an option. Now, this is where the other Chromium browsers, like Google Chrome, Brave, Vivaldi, those ones, you'll end up with a toolbar that goes across the top, and it doesn't have as many options as you see here. So this one here is actually running in, I believe, Chrome. So you end up with options there where you can print. You can send it directly to the printer as you see it on the screen. Next. You can tell it to create a PDF file. Now, if you do that, it actually is going to create a PDF file on the website of the author of the extension. Now, and then you'll get a download button where you can download it. If you have sensitive information or you just don't want it to be stored in the cloud for any amount of time or anything like that, you can always just go and do a normal print to PDF, and it will print the page as you see it there. Next. You have an option here, and this is one of the options you won't get if you're using other Chromium-based browsers, is a style. And this will affect the overall style of the page. So you could go from sans serif to serif. You can change the overall font sizes on the whole web page, bigger or smaller. Change text alignment, things like that. So kind of cool. You can just do the entire page all in one fell swoop. Next. You can get images. And on images, you can have you can resize them, or you can toggle them right on and off. So you can affect things that way. Next. This one is kind of cool, is an edit. And so you can actually edit existing text on the web page, or you can add in brand new text anywhere you want on the web page. And then when you go to print it or PDF it or anything like that, it'll have your additional content or edited content all in the style of that particular website. Next. The last option is the delete option, and this, when you select it, you can then hover your mouse over blocks of text to just delete from the page. And I believe that's it. So it is a really cool extension. I've added it to all my browsers because anytime I want to print or save a web page as a PDF file, it almost never does a nice clean job, and this extension does a nice clean job.
It did actually just pop up one more build here, Chris, at the top right.
If you're on this, you're doing some things and you want to get back to the regular web page, you just click on that icon to cancel it, or there's the close box at the X at the in the bottom of the toolbar. But if you just click the icon, it'll just bring you back to your normal web page. Very nice extension, 100% free. And I highly recommend it.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. And Bob. Bob, there's several people like your Meister Tales. And
thank you.
Several people found out that that's a good print extension, too. So I did ask if anybody had any extra questions. We have a couple of minutes before our scheduled hour. So if anybody has anything else they want to talk about, you could open your mic and actually tell us. Next week, there's lots of room for questions and shares next week. If you have anything you want to add, send it to us at suggestion box, which is what my next slide says, which is the last one for the evening. Our next Q&A session will be next week, next Wednesday, which is July 26th. And as usual, if you have any questions or things you want to follow up on, answers, solutions, fixes, the things that we've talked about, or new topics that you'd like to share with the group, send some information to us at suggestionbox@opcug.ca, and we'll be happy to create some slides or use your slides and reserve a slot for you for next week. That's it for me.
Yeah, I will be wrapping up my free file sync next week, so I'll be doing the final portion on that. Alan and I were discussing a little bit. There's some other things that free file sync can do. So Alan might be taking up the challenge of doing something further on it, but in terms of the replacement of Windows file history, I'll be wrapping that up next week.
Looks like Tom has another question.
Yes, Tom. You're muted.
My computer has died, which is why I'm on an iPad. And I'm looking for a 17-inch gaming computer with a 2.5-inch disk ability to add in, as well as the M.2 ones. And I was wondering if anybody had any suggestions or knowledge to help me choose one.
What's your budget?
Well, probably, it looks like I'm probably going to, I have up to $2,000.
Okay. I recently bought a Lenovo, one of their gaming series, and I really, really like it, but it's probably a little bit higher than that. You might check out Lenovo's systems. As I say, I'm quite happy with it. I shopped around quite a bit before choosing this one. I wanted a really good video card, was one of my criteria for sure. So that sort of knocked out a lot of the lower end systems for me. But
thank you.
I think it's getting hard to find computers that don't have solid-state drives in them now.
That's true. That is probably it's a minority. I found one of the Bing AI told me that there were three computers that had a 2.5-inch drive bay that also with one or more M2s, and one of them is a Gigabyte one, a Dell Alienware, and I think it's Acer Aspire 5. And I've been looking around for those. I haven't been able to actually see much of those on sale, and I'm getting conflicting results when I actually try to confirm that it has a 2.5-inch drive bay. So that's probably my – it's because most of my data is on a 2.5-inch disk that I'd like to be put back inside.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. One thing you may not be in the position of having had a computer die, and you probably want to replace it rather rapidly. But, my advice always to people is if you've got time to do it, shop the sales, because like all of the places like Best Buy and Staples and, Canada Computers and so forth, they have new specials on every week. And so, really shop the specials, because sometimes you get some screaming deals come up and they'll be there for a week and that's it. So, and you never know what it's going to be. So you just get your spec list in order about what it is you really need, what it is you would really like, and then how much you're going to spend, and then shop the sales, because there'll be deals come up and it'll be a weekly thing.
I might mention also, there's deals on Rakuten, and Debbie does that stuff often. You can buy a computer with 12% back on Rakuten, whatever. She scores all these points on Rakuten. You got to go through Rakuten first, or Amazon or whatever. But she checks all these deals, and it's going to change name soon. But there's one for, I think it was Dell Computers for Rakuten for 12% off, I think. It might be still on right now. It adds to your miles, but it really adds up after a while. Anyway, so.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, there was another one. I'm just trying to think of the name of it that I actually signed up for. I was trying to see if I can find one of the emails on it that I got just recently. But there was another site like that where you could sign up for it for free, and then you start your shopping through them. And different places, you could actually save a fair amount of money. I saved quite a bit on my Lenovo computer because they had a deal on, and I think you got like 10% off any Lenovo computer or any device from Lenovo. You got 10% off if you went through them, and it didn't cost anything, so it was kind of handy. And they had other things, other places that they dealt with as well. So that's a good idea, Bob. Yeah.
It's currently now at 2% for Dell stuff and 20% off monitors and accessories. But in the last 2 weeks, it was 20%. I'm sure it was something that was crazy. It's a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. But even 2%, I mean, if it's what you want, why not? Better in your pocket.
Okay, thank you very much.
And I noticed that Harvey had a suggestion to check with Trailing Edge as well. And I would certainly echo that, that they have some good deals, and especially on if you're willing to go used equipment, they certainly have a lot of used equipment that would be available coming off lease mostly.
I looked on their website, and they didn't have much. Okay. I imagine not everything in their store is on the website, though.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I would guess. Yeah. Anyhow, good luck shopping.
Thanks.
Okay, folks, I think we are done for this evening.